Hey, dear listeners, I thought I would answer the patron questions. Let's get to it. This first question is from patron Manny. She writes, "Hey, Dr. Kirk, I got very upset this morning when reading this article on Refinery 29. Just getting to this article. It's called Has Attachment Theory Gone Too Far by Vicky Spratt, June of 2022. Has attachment theory gone too far? Okay, I'm just going to read this and provide my thoughts. So the article starts with a sort of layperson introduction into attachment theory. Then it goes on to talk about how many people will witness people throwing around attachment theory online, on TikTok, while in conversations, while on dating apps. They write about how you might hear someone say, "Oh my God, I went out on a Tinder date with someone and he's so avoidant," or even just reading someone's profile, someone might say, "Oh, that person sounds like they're very preoccupied." So the lingo and the concepts of attachment theory and specifically attachment styles has infiltrated popular culture, which this author says is uncomfortable to witness. And what I'll say there is similar to my take on how people on TikTok will seemingly be acting as though they suffer from various different psychopathologies, most notably dissociative identity disorder, when they probably do not suffer from that disorder, is my stance on that is that when we raise awareness, you know, me and others, thousands of others within my field over the past several decades have been trying to raise awareness about psychopathology and attachment theory and mental issues and how psychotherapy can help and da-da-da. And we have been successful. We have been successful in raising awareness and destigmatizing therapy for a lot of people. I think things are really different now in 2022 as opposed to when I first started out as a therapist. I mean, I would say most people in the 90s, when I told them that I was a therapist, had a very, very uncomfortable reaction to me. And whereas today, people are like, "Oh, I have a therapist." This kind of, or, so now that's Seattle. It's obviously not the entire world, but things are changing. And it's because we've been advocating and speaking out about this for a long time. So there's a benefit to that. But there are some side effects, if you will, to that benefit, which is that people will try to capitalize on the popularity by either believing they suffer from a disorder when they do not, or by just flat out lying because they see people getting attention and they want that attention. Also, you will find that people will bastardize the concepts, will use them in ways that they don't really understand, like the concept of gaslighting or narcissism. We have been trying to raise awareness of these real issues, but the side effect is that people will hear a tiny little explanation of it and misunderstand it and then run with it, most notably gaslighting, and then use it in a way that is inaccurate and sometimes flat out offensive to people who have actually been gaslit and abused long term. So when it comes to attachment theory, we're seeing a similar thing. I think for people just to know that attachment styles exist is a huge success in my field. And I find many people do understand it fairly well. And I would imagine a good number of people, even on a Tinder date, are applying those concepts well. I don't know for sure, but I've seen that anecdotally. Also, I imagine people are misusing it, and not only in an innocuous way, but also in a harmful way, harming themselves or other people. Absolutely. So does that mean we throw out attachment theory? No, it just means we try to educate people further, try to raise awareness that people don't necessarily understand what they're talking about and they want to be careful because they could either misuse it or harm themselves by conceptualizing things in a way that is inaccurate. You know, if you look at something inaccurately, you can make decisions based on that inaccurate conceptualizations that will not be great, right? So let's get back to the article. And then there's a brief section where they talk about some anecdotes of individuals who have seen attachment theory change their life for the better, both by seeking therapists that focus on attachment and also reading books, popular books that are educational around attachment. Then it goes on to talk about how certain books are very popular and selling millions of copies that are self-help books about attachment theory. And then they provide some quotes from these books that are seemingly a little overgeneralizing. And then they go on to say that these books imply that there's a hierarchy of personalities, meaning that you have secure people at the top, and anxious and avoidant people are damaged and are problematic in these various ways. And what I will say is, I mean, to say there's a hierarchy is inherently looking at people with insecure attachment as being below or something. And there is some truth to that paradigm in my field. In fact, often the graphical representations, they'll put secure at the top and insecure at the bottom, which is probably something for us to look at. But then they go on to say, can people in all their complexity really be so neatly categorized? Is there not a danger that boxing people in like this at best limits our interactions with them and at worst colors how we see them? And surely when it gets to the point that you're diagnosing the attachment style of people you've barely or even never met, something has gone very wrong. So just jumping in here. Yeah. Can people in all their complexity really be so neatly categorized? No. And people who are expert in attachment theory and attachment styles understand that to categorize all 8 billion people on the planet into 4 distinct categories is not possible. And you'll often hear me talk about this, that I've rarely met someone who fits neatly into one of the categories. There's different amounts. Like what I say about myself is I would, based on my own kind of gauge, I'm probably half or maybe 60% secure-ish. And then I have a good amount, you know, 30%, 25% of avoidant and maybe 5, 10% of preoccupied. But even with that categorization, does that really describe who I am? Can that predict my behavior? Does it say how much therapy I've been through? Does it say how good of a partner I would be in a relationship? No, it just provides a jumping off point. It's the topic sentence of my attachment reactivity. And maybe a good takeaway from what this article is illuminating is that people are reducing attachment theory and personality to really only 3 categories, because usually disorganized is left off the list. And when it is discussed, it's usually not described very accurately, in my opinion. Often people will just reduce it to a combination of avoidant and preoccupied, which is really far off the mark. The other thing is that human personality is complicated. Behavior is complicated. As a field, for decades, over a century, we've been trying to predict human behavior, individuals. I mean, it's fairly easy to predict the behavior of a group, but it's very hard to predict the behavior of an individual. Even when you have days and days and weeks and months of observation and study, I mean, there's certain things we can absolutely say, you know, like the individual will likely feel sleepy after a certain amount of hours awake. The individual will want to eat, want to go to the bathroom, have an urge to drink water, this kind of thing. And these are all, you could say, psychologically studied areas. But when it comes to relationships, will this person want to be with this other particular person? Will they be happy in the future? Will they be depressed? What sort of job will they have in the future if we're looking at teenagers? These things are very difficult to assess, especially when we're thinking about even micro behaviors. Like if someone is presented with 5 choices of art, which one will they like? It's almost impossible to predict those kinds of behaviors. And that's very frustrating to us as a field. And we've been able to develop some guidelines, some predictive power, like the big 5 personality traits. Attachment theory also is another one. But those are pretty limiting and certainly don't describe the entire, you know, human being. If I gave you my big 5 score and my attachment style score, so to speak, especially when we reduce it to just one of the 4 categories, you know, like this person is secure. Like I would and have tested as a secure attachment individual. But does that describe my attachment reactivity and all of its complexities? No, not at all. And the descriptions are also pretty vague, right? It was, you know, there's a, for secure people, there's a tendency to do this, or more often than not, they will do this, or on the inside, they will have these feelings and report these awarenesses of these feelings, or they tend to have less likelihood of drug addiction or psychopathology. But that doesn't mean they don't, you know, that doesn't mean that people with secure attachment don't have drug addiction, don't have psychopathology, because they do. So when we're trying to reduce people down to just an attachment style, then yeah, that's really short-sighted. And many people in my field, including myself, might dip into that generalization and that reductionistic way of looking at human beings. And I hope that I try to exhibit tentativeness or at least caveats around these kinds of generalizations that are in line with the research. Okay, I read more of the article just now, and a lot of it is well written. They're making a good case, and they're seemingly, they have a finger on the pulse of the internet in terms of the psychology talk that's happening. They talk a bit about narcissism and how some people will be hurt that someone didn't want to date them, and they will label their former partner as narcissistic when there's no way to know that, of course. And then they go on to say that they talk about how avoidant people, avoidant attachment style individuals are quote unquote self-sufficient. And they say, what's wrong with that? Isn't that an admirable quality in a partner? And what I'll say to that is, yeah, absolutely. And we know that avoidant attached individuals and their self-sufficiency is a positive. It can be a positive, but it's also a negative in that they are pathologically self-sufficient. Pathologically independent is the phrase that I think I made up. Sometimes I have to be careful not to claim that. I can't remember reading it. But anyway, the point is that avoidant attached individuals are so independent, so self-sufficient that they don't ask for help. They don't indicate their needs. They don't even know if they're particularly down the road of avoidance. They don't even know their needs. They're like, yeah, I'm fine. I'm good. Everything's fine. You know, like my somewhat avoidant nature is exhibited by a common feature, which is that when I move, you know, if I'm moving from an apartment to another apartment, I never ask for help. It doesn't even occur to me to ask for help, even though many of my friends, when they would move, would ask me for help and I would gladly help. But when I moved, it didn't even occur to me to ask people, even though that was being modeled for me all around. I would pack everything into my Honda Civic in a series of 55 trips across town and slowly move my crap from one place to another and be totally fine with it. I wouldn't be grumbling. In some ways, I didn't really want other people to help me because I didn't want to bother other people. And I didn't want other people to feel obligated or something, you know? And so that's one of the common features. You know, when I'm lecturing about this, I'll be like, you know, avoidant people, when they move, they don't ask for help, you know? And there's always a few people that will say, oh, that's me. So yeah, it is good that we don't bother other people, that we can manage on our own, that we're independent, we're not dependent. But if you don't know your needs, like when you're sad or when you need support, you know, like for example, avoidant people don't go to the doctor and will suffer from a preventable health issue that could have been nipped in the bud in the beginning, but they won't go to a physician because they're, you know, pathologically independent, that kind of thing. It's a problem. And when I read this part of the article, it just makes me think that the person doesn't really understand attachment theory. They're zeroing in on things that are being said. And it just makes me even wonder if they've read the books that they're criticizing, because in those books, and when they talk about people who are self-sufficient as avoidant individuals, avoidant attached individuals, at least in my experience, they usually talk about what I'm saying right now. The same can be said about people who are preoccupied attached. These individuals are very oriented towards other people and are terrified of attachment loss. So they're very interested in retaining their attachments. They're preoccupied with those relationships. So on one level, that provides with a lot of strength. They know their emotions much better than attached individuals. They are very in tune, attuned to other people's emotions, particularly their attachment figures. They can distort sometimes, but sometimes not, oftentimes not, if they're particularly good at reading other people's minds and thoughts and, you know, picking up on the cues. They also work hard to keep relationships. They put a lot of effort. They reach out a lot. These are strengths, right? But the flip side is there's tremendous terror. There's tremendous fear and paranoia about what is going on in the other person's mind. So that's the shadow side of that, right? Okay, so reading more into the article, I can see why this was bothering patron Manny. And that's often the case. You know, with these articles, they start with reasonable things and then they start to get into more and more unreasonable things. And at this phase, about, I don't know, 30% of the article, they start criticizing John Bowlby and Mary Ainsworth. And they're characterizing John Bowlby's attachment theory and the work of Mary Ainsworth as being sexist against women, which is ridiculous. So basically, to the layperson, if they're looking for something to criticize, what they will notice in the 1950s written research by John Bowlby and others, that they are always referring to the parent as the mother, as she. They will say when the mother is caring for the child, when the mother is attuned, when the mother is not attuned, when the mother is a secure base for the child, that kind of language. And it's not always the case, but it often was. In our 2022, you know, the year 2022 eyes, you look back at that, you're like, well, why? How come you're not including men? Well, one, the vast majority of parents were the mothers. And if not like literally everyone in their clinical practice. Now, does that mean you should exclude, even if it was 1% of the parents were the fathers, does that mean you refer to all parents as mothers? No, you shouldn't. Even if it's 0.1%, you shouldn't gender the parent in that way. And, you know, over the past number of decades, we've been moving away from that sort of language. So there's that. Two, back then, people did that. You know, we're talking about the 50s, you know, and we can't judge the past based on our current mores. We can look at it and say, what does that say about society? But it's really problematic to judge individuals in the past for doing what everyone else has done. For example, one of the, this is just a side note, things in our history is that at the founding of the United States and the late 1700s, when we look at the right to vote, it is very exclusionary. It excludes women. It excludes people. I think it excluded Catholics. It excludes black people. It excludes, you know, all sorts of people. Essentially, only rich landowners, white men, Protestants could vote. And we look at that and we're like, man, that's fascist. That's oppressive. That's racist. That's awful. And it is. However, when you compare the structure of the early United States government to other structures of government around the world, the United States was by far astronomically more liberal and more inclusive than any other government that was around at the time. Now, might there be some pockets of even larger democracies around the world? Yeah, but when compared to where, you know, the United States came from, you know, Western Europe, the United States, one, we didn't have a king. I mean, just that alone, right? So there was a lot of progression there. And slowly but surely, the enfranchisement, the right to vote was expanded to more and more people. So we can look at that and say they're fascists, or we can look at that and say, well, in comparison to where they're coming from, they were very inclusive. They had a long way to go, but they were very inclusive. So when we look at John Bowlby in the 50s and see that he is phrasing all parents as the mothers, we would say, oh, he's sexist, right? But when we think of where he was coming from, he was raising awarenesses that were very oppressive to mothers, to children, to families, to development. The idea that attachment and emotion and relationships are important is a very anti-paternalistic idea. It's a very feminist idea. The main ideas at the time were psychoanalysis and behaviorism, and to some extent, emerging cognitivism, which are good theories and worthy, but often, particularly the way it was implemented at the time by the majority, is completely discounting of emotion, of attachment, of relationships, of parenting, of one's experience growing up, and was, you know, psychopathologizing people on in other ways. And so in relation to that, one could say that John Bowlby had a very progressive feminist way of looking at human beings and development. Now, the article goes on to say that our society loves to blame parents and particularly mothers, and I think even within our field, we have done that as well, which is absolutely true. That is true, that in our field and in our society, when there's a problem with a child, it would be the blame would be foisted on the mother, and there, you know, it's all just wrapped up in sexism and all that kind of stuff. So both of those things can be true. But to point to 1950s John Bowlby research and literature and say that it's sexist and thus ridiculous is extremely short-sighted. And so I just read a little bit more. This is just, it's just, yeah, it's so silly. So now some art, you know, it's just an article, right? Big deal. But to paint attachment theory in this way might drive people away from it. And it's such a powerful, helpful idea. It's, you know, I don't know. I'm sure I don't have to convince y'all of that. But anyway, in the article, it goes on to say that attachment theory by John Bowlby and Mary Ainsworth blames women for not being there for their children, for not being a secure base, for not being attuned. And then it goes on to say, well, women were busy or distracted by, they say, going out and earning enough money to feed us during our childhoods. That, so essentially what they're saying is, so because women went back to work and asserted themselves, that women are being blamed for the adults' attachment styles. You know what I'm saying? And no, that is not, at no point. Now, might some author have utilized attachment theory to oppress women and keep them home? Yeah, I'm sure that happened. But I've never heard an attachment theorist expert, bring that up, that conservative idea that mothers are to blame and thus should never leave the house because if they do so, they're going to create insecure children. That I've never heard anyone talk like that. Now, generally speaking, I have talked about, and others will, that parenting has changed over the years to promote more insecurity in children because of pressures and societal changes around materialism, and thus you have to work 70 hours a week. And regardless of the gender of the parent, when parents spend more time at work, less time with their children, and when the parents are home, they're on their phones, they're emailing, they're on Zoom, doing other kinds of work-related things, distracted from their natural tendency to want to parent their children, then yeah, you're going to see an issue there. But it doesn't have anything to do with keeping women home. Then it goes on to identify research that I will see as a total valid criticism of attachment theory. So this next paragraph is I actually will stand behind to some extent, meaning that there's research out there saying that when you test someone, even when you thoroughly test someone and you identify their attachment style, it is hard and not always the case where you can generalize their relationship behavior, the type of relationship they're in. It's hard to generalize their behavior at work. It's also hard to attach that attachment. It's hard to correlate that attachment style with specific childhood experiences. And yeah, so this is a very complex thing because humans are complex. And sometimes attachment theory is applied in this very blunt way. And sometimes I will do it too, meaning that so say someone comes into my office and they exhibit preoccupied attachment, and say I'm not following my own complicated assessment and conceptualization, say I'm thinking very simplistically, and I say, okay, well, obviously this person is preoccupied, and so obviously they had inconsistent parents. So the classic cause of preoccupied attachment is when the parents were inconsistently attuned. They were sometimes attuned, sometimes even when they're attuned, they're not very attuned, but they're attuned kind of, and then other times they're not. And to make that assumption is not great, because it doesn't always pan out that way. There are many different paths to preoccupation. The other thing is that you can have a relatively good childhood on average and then go through difficult attachments in your teen years with your peers, with a partner in your 20s, and develop preoccupation from that. The other thing is, when we look at studies along these lines of attachment and childhood, we are often interviewing an adult, figuring out their attachment style, and then asking that same adult to remember their childhood, which of course is fraught with memory problems, right? And narrative issues. The other thing is hardly anyone remembers the years between 0 and 3, which is where most of the attachment develop, or at least a good portion of the attachment develop, the development exists. And I've talked about this before, where you can find yourself like, man, you know, I really am insecurely attached as an adult, but my parents are, they're still together. They're very stable. They don't drink. Everything's fine. They don't fight. They're very loving. I don't know what's going on. And when we dive in more into the details, we hear from the parents that one or both of them was very stressed out with something while the child was, say, 6 months to 12 months, or, you know, 6 to 18 months. One of the parents was depressed, or one of the parents was working a lot, or one of the parents traveled a lot, or the parents are going through a little bit of a conflict. There was a lot of distance, or the parents are very young and they didn't really know what they were doing, or, you know, just various different factors that affected them temporarily when you were an infant, but wasn't present later on. That can absolutely affect things. Now, how do we correlate those things? How do we know that those things happened? We can't. In order for us to know the answers to these questions, we would have to experiment on infants. We would have to take thousands of infants and raise them in different ways purposely. We would have to raise some infants as a way, you know, inconsistently on purpose to see how many of those kids develop preoccupied attachment. And of course, that's incredibly unethical and immoral and horrible. We'll never be able to do that. So it's impossible to know for sure. But the way that I have understood attachment theory, it tends to pan out when you apply it in a individualistic way. The other problem is that, say, I have the client, preoccupied a client that is in my office. I know nothing about their coping with it. I know nothing about their awareness of their preoccupation. So you could have, say, two different preoccupied people, hypothetically. And there are probably thousands of presentations I could present, but just thinking of two, you know, in stark contrast, you have one preoccupied person that has no idea that they're preoccupied. They have very little insight into their emotions and their attachment reactivity and their relationships and their childhood. They're at the very beginning of their learning process. And they believe everyone else is the problem and that they're normal and, you know, that kind of mindset. But they're preoccupied, right? They tend to react in a preoccupied way. They tend to have feelings that are indicative of preoccupied attachment. They have impulses that are indicative of preoccupied attachment. The second client has been through 15 years of therapy. They've listened to all sorts of podcasts and read all sorts of books about attachment theory. They have a partner that knows about attachment theory. They've been to therapy, couples therapy. They are very aware. They still have the impulses, they still have the reactivity, but they learn how to manage it better, they vocalize it more, they verbalize it more. And for that person, their relationship is perhaps one of the best relationships in town. Whereas the first person that has no awareness of their preoccupation might have some of the worst relationships in town. Both are preoccupied, yet very different in terms of how their life is playing out. So this is obvious, right? And for people, lay individuals, to claim that, okay, this person tests as preoccupied, they must have terrible relationships, is of course silly. And for the author of this article to claim that that's what we say, that by testing someone and their attachment style can tell you everything about them, is of course silly as well. That's a straw man. Okay, just going on with the article, there's a bunch of stuff I don't need to comment on necessarily, but a couple of things here is that the author is comparing people's usage of attachment styles as similar to how people use astrology, they will say. oh, he's so avoidant, in the same way that someone might say, oh, he's such an Aries, that kind of thing. And yeah, do people use it that way? 100%. But that doesn't discount the theory. The other thing that the author is putting forth is that avoidants are maligned while preoccupied people are not, meaning that avoidant, according to them, avoidantly attached individuals are said to be problematic, whereas preoccupied people are said to be just fine, which is not my anecdotal experience. I usually find that online in conversations that preoccupied people are the people that are stigmatized, and avoidance are held up as being the American ideal, as the self-sufficient, non-emotional one, right? So, you know, I guess each to their own on that topic. But they're also pointing that they seem, that the author seems to be paying attention to a lot of online talk about from, as they put it, cis women labeling their male partners as avoidance. You know, that they're saying, oh, he's so avoidant because he doesn't text me back, or he's such an avoidant attached individual because he, you know, doesn't like it when I, you know, break all of his boundaries, that kind of thing. Then it goes on to quote someone, I think, maybe an expert, talking about how labeling people as a particular attachment style limits things. So I'll paraphrase what I think they're saying. They're saying that, you know, you might have someone who is married to someone who is avoidant attached, and you're like, oh, well, they can't help it because they're avoidant attached. And you might also see everything that they do through that lens, even though it might not be from that place. You know, they're not seeing the individual accurately. And what I'll say is, well, yeah, I suppose if someone's using a attachment theory in a destructive way or in a problematic way, that's what they might do. But in my experience, as all of you know, because I talk about it often, is that when we can understand other people's attachment reactivity, regardless of the label we put to it, and that's often what I will talk about with people, is forget about the label. Just think about the way in which you and your partner react to attachment threat and to attachment satisfaction. So when you yourself feel as though your partner is distancing themselves from you, when you feel like they're hurting your feelings or they're not paying enough attention to you or something like that, what do you do? What feelings do you have? What behaviors do you have an impulse to engage in? What behaviors do you focus on in the other person? What's your tendency? Because I pretty much can guarantee you that you have a tendency. Now, we could call that preoccupied, disorganized, avoidant, secure, whatever. But that's just the opening, that's just the title of the book. You know, avoidant attachment is the title. And then the chapters are, through my avoidant attachment, I do this. And then you have an entire chapter written about your particular way that it plays out. To say that you could just know everything about someone based on the title of the book is silly, right? The other thing is that in this article, they seem to be saying that we believe as attachment theorists that your attachment style means that you can't control your behavior, that you're doomed to exhibit your attachment style, which is, of course, ridiculous. No one thinks that who's an expert in attachment theory. There's a lot of opportunity for change, one, and two, variability. You give people, like for me, for example, and I've talked about this before, that when I'm in a relationship where there are very few threats to my attachment security, then I exhibit secure attachment behavior and thinking and feeling. When I am with someone who is invasive of me, that is pursuing of me, I become avoidant. When someone is very avoidant with me, like even more avoidant than I am, then I become preoccupied. So that's my, you know, if you write my whole novel, those would be some of the topic sentences or the chapter titles. And then, of course, my particular way of doing that and sort of how I've developed over time is the whole book, right? So to say that it's beyond my control. Oh, so my point is that once I become aware of that, then I can interpret my feelings and my impulses and know that even though I have an impulse, you know, my pattern, my old tape, if you will, of reactivity to, say, someone who is pursuing me, someone who's invading me, is to avoid. When I know that, I say, oh, I need to maybe do this other thing instead, because if I avoid, it's just going to cause them to be more preoccupied with me, and I don't want that, and they don't want that. So, you know, if I'm more open about what is happening, more vulnerable, this kind of thing. So by no means is it beyond our control, as this article puts it. And maybe this is the problem, is that as people learn about attachment theory, even within my field, they will reduce it to the attachment styles, and that ends their education on it. When you really understand what John Bowlby was talking about, because remember that John Bowlby, attachment styles were not a big part of his literature. If you really read what he writes, attachment styles don't come up very often. When you actually understand the foundation of attachment theory, that we are born to attach, we are born with a natural need to attach, to have security, to seek attunement, to do things to garner attunement from our parents. And when we don't get those things, we have to deal with that. We have to cope with that in some way. And we develop schemas that could be called attachment styles growing up. When you understand that and really understand it, when you really get it, then you understand, you have a foundation upon which you can understand yourself and other people, your clients. Everything that I do is understood through this lens. At work, you know, you're talking to your boss, and your boss is wanting you to stay late after, you know, they want you to work on Saturday. And for you, you're like, well, I don't want to work on Saturday. So attachment theory is at play here. There's a practicality to it, but there's also attachment, in terms of the way I see it, there's an attachment theory angle to this, which is that we don't want to be rejected. And depending on how you deal with rejection, because we're always seeking attunement and proximity and attachment and acceptance from other people. So let's say that you are a pleaser, which is part of your attachment reactivity. In order to retain attachments, you learned early on that you had to overplease and discount your own needs. In that situation, your boss is telling you to work on Saturday, you might say, okay, I'll work on Saturday. But all the while, you're denying your own needs. You might not even really be aware of your own needs because you learned early in life that you couldn't really focus on that. It's not within an attachment theory, it's not within an attachment style per se, but it is understood through an attachment lens in my mind. And your boss also is dealing with an attachment issue because in all likelihood, they're only asking you to work on Saturday because of some threat to them from a number of different angles from their boss or from some other direction. And they're worried about, being rejected and lacking attunement from other people. Maybe they want to go home so that they can bond with their family, and they don't want to work on Saturday. So they're making you work. You know, when you understand our needs in this way and you understand our tendencies when we run into threats, then it really explains a lot of our foibles and can really inform how to get our needs met and how to meet the needs of other people. And what I would say to the author of this article is, okay, well, what alternative theory or framework of conceptualization would you offer as a way of understanding dating? Because if you have a better one, then by all means, share it. Let's work with that. But if we don't have one, then attachment theory is one of the best, if not the best frameworks of trying to understand our behavior in relationships, and is extremely helpful when used correctly, when used in a helpful way, when used in a responsible, research-oriented, research-based way. Okay, the last thing on this article that I'll comment on is it labels secure attached unicorns, meaning that the way we describe securely attached individuals, they don't seem to exist in the world, right? And they're mythical. They're a fantasy. And what I'll say is, to some extent, that's true. But when you really understand what the research, Mary Ainsworth, John Bowlby, were talking about when they were referring to those who were at the end of the spectrum of securely attached individuals, it's just people who... So let me describe the expert way of looking at this. Say I have a client, they come into my office and I find that, they fit neatly into the securely attached category, meaning that when they have an attachment threat, they tend not to cope with that in a way that destroys their life or destroys their relationship. That's, in a nutshell, essentially what's happening. They tend not to misinterpret what's happening in the other person's mind. You know, the preoccupied person tends to be overly paranoid. The avoidant person tends to be unaware to some extent. In a nutshell. So the securely attached individual tends not to do that. Now, you notice I'm using the word tends. Can a secure individual act like a preoccupied one or act like an avoidant one. Yeah, absolutely. And often will. So this individual is just a little bit better able to manage relationships without being paranoid, without discounting their own needs and other people. But might they have massive amounts of conflict and relationship distress? Yes. Research shows that. Being securely attached does not mean that your relationships are all without problems. But when you read online, when lay people will describe securely attached individuals, they might characterize it that way, which is, of course, silly. It's just it's a tendency, right? Now, how do we define someone? Where's the line between the insecure and the secure? Well, it's in the eye of the beholder, right? It depends on what you look at, depends on your opinion. And personally, I'm not interested in that. When I have a client or a student or even myself or my wife, I don't care about where exactly they are in terms of the spectrum of secure and insecure. I might note that, I might have that as a topic sentence, but really it comes down to the specific way that things play out. And with the couples that I work with, it's so complicated. You know, I might be able to label one person this, one person that, but the way in which the attachment plays out in the relationship is so complicated and so specific. But when I see people through that lens, it is very illuminating, very helpful. I'll just put it that way. All right, let's take a break. Get back more patron emails. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a new year, so of course it's time for New Year's resolutions. But often, those are just manifestations of internalized harmful voices, voices that tell us we're not good enough. So instead of making a resolution to change something, let's recognize that we are already good enough. Now, most people think of therapy as a place for us to work on our problems, but there are several schools of thought within the field of psychotherapy that adamantly reject that paradigm, like narrative therapy and solution-focused. Instead, these clinicians help us focus on what we're already doing well. And by helping us do that, data shows that we often will gravitate towards more beneficial patterns. Well, one place you can find such therapists is on BetterHelp. If you're thinking of starting therapy, it's definitely worth giving a try. So, celebrate the progress you've already made. Visit betterhelp.com/Kirk today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/Kirk.
استمع إلى بودكاست رام قوتك من قلبك برعاية رام على تطبيق أبل بودكاست، سبوتيفاي أو أي منصة صوتية أخرى. في هذه الرحلة نكتشف مع بعض خلال شهر رمضان الكريم شلون نكون بقمة عطائنا المعنوي الفكري والإنساني ونستمد من هذا الشهر الكريم مصدر قوتنا الداخلية والخارجية.
All right, we're back from the break. I want to thank Patron Manny for sending that article. It's interesting to read, kind of upsetting to read on some level. But anyway, it's just upsetting because when you have an author that clearly has a bone to pick and sought experts who are against attachment theory for one reason or another, it's like, is that, I don't know, I guess every journalist can do what they want to do, but you could have talked to an expert who actually could say, yes, I agree with what you're saying, and here's what expert attachment theory people would say. The article seems to be portraying the way lay people utilize attachment theory as attachment theory, which is, you know, I don't think very cool. And again, if you were talking about the Seattle Seahawks, the football team, and, you know, giving an opinion about that, it's like, well, who cares? Just a stupid football team. But when you're talking about a theory that can and has improved the lives of millions of people and you're denigrating it, I think it's irresponsible because it could steer people away from something that would really help them. Anyway, I also want to provide an announcement. So Jocelyn, she reached out to me. She's in college and she's learning how to design websites. And so she reached out to me because she's like, you know, I'm a fan of the podcast and I think your website could use some improvement, which I agree. And I want to, as a project for college, I want to redesign your website. And so she wanted me to read the following thing. Thanks. One of our listeners who is a designer has offered to redesign the Psychology in Seattle website to make it more user-friendly. If you would like to help, she is looking for participants to share what they like and don't like about the current website in a 20-minute interview. To sign up for an interview or simply share feedback about the website, please reach out to Jocelyn at psychologyinseattleredesign@gmail.com. That's psychologyinseattleredesign@gmail.com. Huge thank you to everyone who participates. End of her message. Yeah, so I second that. I want the website to be as useful as possible for people. And up until this point, it's been 14 years of essentially just me designing the website, and I know nothing about website design. And Jocelyn has already provided, just in a brief conversation on the phone, some very helpful ideas about how to categorize the 1,500 episodes to make them easier to find, that kind of thing. So if you want to help out, then you could reach out to psychologyinseattleredesign@gmail.com, talk with Jocelyn, and she would like to interview you. All right, let's go on with another email. All right, patron Rachel asks, I just read the Mayo Clinic's personality disorder page. I saw under schizotypal, the traits seem to line up with the New Age communities like Teal Swans. It got me wondering, has anyone ever done that? Diagnosed a whole community with a personality disorder? Now I'm thinking of meowing nuns. Meowing really is kind of contagious. End of email. Well, that last bit, meowing nuns, nuns who meow, like there's a contagious meow within a nun community. I did not know that. It's interesting. I'm not surprised. There's been many documented cases of that kind of behavior and that kind of contagion. But to get to your other question, well, there's a couple ideas. One is that you reading schizotypal and its traits, one, it's really hard to understand any personality disorder, schizotypal in particular. Schizotypal is very odd to read the description. You're like, huh? You really have to meet someone with schizotypal and even better yet, treat someone with schizotypal like I have. It is very particular. And there are a number of different types as well. So there's that. But then you say they seem to line up with New Age communities like Teal Swan's community. I think what you're referring to is the symptom of schizotypal, that there's magical thinking and this kind of thing. Is that true? And might people diagnose an entire community with schizotypal personality disorder? No. I mean, I'm sure someone has done that, but that's not responsible. It's not conceptually accurate. You couldn't, to suffer from personality disorder, it has to be generalizable to their personality in all contexts. So for example, take someone that clearly does not have schizotypal and they, say they suffer from suicide. I think this is actually a common path. Obviously not everyone, but to Teal Swan, who they suffer from depression and suicidality, and they find Teal Swan online and they're like, oh, finally, someone is just talking about suicide in an open way. It's such a rare thing. And yes, I have had bad experiences with therapists in the past, and Teal Swan is really validating me in that way. So the individual reaches out to Teal Swan and gets involved deep in the community and is introduced to all these other ideas about seeing ghosts and auras and all this other kind of supernatural, unscientific stuff. And the individual gets indoctrinated into that world because it feels good to be accepted, and the community is very important to them. And so you end up adopting the point of view. You might even literally start seeing auras and ghosts and other kind, or feeling like a spirit is inside of you, the spirit of someone else's loved one, that kind of thing. You're channeling. It feels real. It you're not lying when you have those experiences. The human mind is very malleable in that way. Does that person suffer from at least one of the symptoms of schizotypal? No. They've been indoctrinated into a way of thinking. But yeah, I mean, could one, in a sort of poetic way, describe a community as being schizotypal or something along those lines? Yeah, but you couldn't obviously diagnose every individual in that community with that disorder. All right, this next email is from patron Chanel from San Diego. She writes, can you please talk about the mental health implications of the media interviewing the victims, particularly the children of the Robb Elementary school shooting and other school shootings? I am worried that the media, as well as the parents, are unaware that recounting the trauma without appropriate safety measures can potentially re-traumatize the victims. End of email. Yeah, it's complicated. So there's a lot of things that are bandied about. One is that there's a lot of simplistic ideas are bandied about. One simplistic idea is you got to get people talking right away. That's what will help people. And that's a massive oversimplification. And research has shown that when you force people to talk about a traumatic event right after it happens, you can actually increase the risk of post-traumatic stress disorder in some individuals. Another idea that gets simplistic idea that gets bandy about is that you shouldn't talk with people about the trauma. This is in line with, I think, the backlash to the forcing the, you know, the crisis therapy model. So it's a backlash to that, but also just the general cultural notion that you're not supposed to talk about trauma because it'll just make it worse, which is of course not true. And also the notion, the false notion that children don't really need to talk about these things because they're children. They're not really fully formed human beings yet, which is also silly. So what I'll say is it's complicated. Now, should the media be allowed, as you're saying, to just interview the kids because they're trying to sell commercials on their TV station? I would say no, they should not. There's no reason for that, right? It's not a public good that children are on the news talking about what they went through. So I would say the risk far outweighs the benefit. But could some kids actually benefit by talking to the media? Yeah. Some kids might actually be able to grieve more. So they get some validation, or they are able to speak their truth. You know, you could see a kid who went through a really difficult school shooting and they want to talk about the bravery of their teacher, or how great their teacher was, or how scary it was and how people really needed to pay attention to this. And the fifth grader, the kid who was speaking in the media, really feels proud of what they did. They participated in speaking their mind and honoring the people that have died, and by being an activist for change. That could be a positive to that fifth grader. But it would be very hard to predict whether or not interviewing a kid would be a positive for them. You know, it's the same with kids who are in movies and TV, reality TV, this kind of thing. It could be a very positive thing for some kids, but it obviously could be a very negative thing, and there would be no way to know. Now, might there be a way to know? Might we be able to point to some markers that would indicate risks here and there? We might be able to, but do we really want to leave the media and marketers with that responsibility? No, I think we should just not be doing it. But what do we do? So if we just put the media aside, what do we do as a community as we go through the, you know, a more common, because school shootings are extremely uncommon. Even though they are talked about incessantly in the news, the chance of your child being in a school, you know, involved in a school. I think one of the problems is that we just underestimate how many elementary schools there are in the United States. And it just feels like, you know, if you ask the average American, how many, you know, elementary schools do you think there are in the United States? They'd probably be like, oh, I don't know, maybe like 500 or I don't know what people would say. But anyway, my point is that it's extremely unlikely to happen, but a much more common, not that we shouldn't do anything about it, because we should, obviously, but the more common thing is, say, a kid at school dies of suicide, or a teacher dies suddenly in a car accident, or something like that. Much more common thing that is almost universal. It's pretty common for a kid to die suddenly at the school that your kid is at. And what do you do then? Do you drag every kid, all the kids, into an assembly and talk about it? Do you force grief counseling on all the kids? Do you offer it? Do you sweep it under the rug? You know, what do you do? It's hard to know. And there are guidelines for sure. And I'm not aware of them because I don't work at these organizations. It's not part of my research area. But you know, there are guidelines to follow for sure. And, you know, you just want to seek out that expert opinion. But even when you the guidelines that I've come across, I think are great, but they don't really tell you what to do, and you don't really know. And every kid, every situation is going to be different. Every kid's going to be different. So the key that I will tell everyone right here and right now is that you as a parent need to provide flexibility and openness to your child and let them lead the way. So for example, you have a kid, a fifth grader, who their classmate died suddenly in a car accident. And you don't know what to do. Well, understand it's going to be a little messy because it's a messy, difficult situation. So just accept that. There's not going to be a clear road ahead and you don't know what's going to happen. It's hard to predict. So, but you go to your fifth grader and you say, hey, you know, I just wanted to ask you or tell you that if you wanted to talk about what happened at school, I would love to talk about it with you, but you don't have to talk with me about it. And a lot of times when we go through things like this, it's confusing and it feels good to just get things off our chest. And you might even lead the way with yourself. You'd be like, yeah, you know, when I was a kid, I went through a similar situation and I found that it felt good to be able to talk about it with other people. But I didn't want to be forced to talk about it. You know, you sort of self-disclose in that way. And that's the intro. And then as time goes on, especially in the immediate days and weeks, you might introduce other things. You might notice things, you know, hey, you know, I just wanted to see how you're doing. And if you're properly attuned and you have a routine with your child along these lines, then things will tend to work out. Might they not work out? Yeah, because your kid has a lot of other things going on. You know, they have peer relationships and other societal issues that are going on that you don't have any control over, really. But if you can, as a parent, provide some solace, some sanctuary where the child can talk about it or not talk about it, then, and the child knows that you're not going to freak out. You know, the mistakes, the pitfalls that I'll see parents fall into is they'll either offer, but they really don't want to talk about with their kid because they're uncomfortable, which the child will pick up on that vibe, or the parent will really force the kid. Like there were many times back when I did family therapy, the family would drag the kid in and say, you know, Johnny's dad died last year and refuses to talk about it. So I'm bringing him into therapy so that you can basically force him to talk about the fact that his dad died last year. And I knew the main issue I had to work on was the parents at that point, was to be like, one, you're operating from a paradigm that is simplistic. It's a good heuristic, right? That when we go through a tremendous loss, talking about it is healthy because generally speaking, that's true. And when someone isn't talking about it, that could be an indication that something wrong is happening, something damaging, something bad is happening. That is maybe true. That second one's harder to know, but you know, you're operating from that assumption. That's fine. But to force a kid to talk about, and I would see therapists do this as well. And I probably was guilty of this when I first started out as a therapist. So it's way more complicated than that. You want the kid to, because when you create an environment where there is true flexibility, where the child knows what they could do, and that if they did those things as it occurred to them, you would react in a way that they wanted you to react. You know, because some kids, they don't want you to pay attention. The child might come to you and say, I drew this picture of dad who died last year. You know, I drew this picture of dad. Some kids want you to focus on that as an opener to a larger conversation. Some kids don't. They just want to share this picture with you and have you go, that's a great picture of dad. I bet you he would have loved that. I like that picture. And they don't want you to focus. So that's what attuned or being flexible, right? So you might test the water. So say in that scenario, the kid brings a picture of their deceased father, and you say, okay, what do I do here? Well, you might test the waters. You'd be like, oh, wow, I love this picture. Did you want to talk about dad for a bit? Because, you know, we could if you want to. And the kid's like, nah, I just wanted to show you this picture. And you get the picture, you get the vibe that they're being honest, that they really aren't interested in talking about dad in this moment. Then you just let it go. You know, you just, oh, well, okay, cool. And you want to give the vibe that you're okay that they turned you down in that way, right? You don't want to give them this idea that you feel hurt that they don't want to talk with you about their dad. You know, it's complicated, right? And as a therapist, this is what I did. The reason why I'm talking with such, you know, some microness of this is that I did this as a therapist. People would be dragged into my office with this exact thing and say the client draws a picture of their dad, gives it to me. Over time, I learned that you have to be flexible and you have to gauge. And while you're gauging, while you're probing and asking questions, not only are you trying to get the answer to these questions, but you also want to give the message that any answer to this question is okay with me. You know, do you want to talk about your dad? If you ask that question of your child, you have to do your best to give the impression or just flat out say, you could say yes or no to that question, or maybe to that, you can answer maybe, and I will be okay with that because there's no right way to do this. There's no requirement here. You get to drive the bus. I'm just asking you what you want. I'm providing a menu. You can order anything off the menu, or you could walk out of the restaurant. No problem. No harm, no foul, whatever you want. And when you provide that invitation, that flexible, unconditional invitation, then naturally the child will step into what they will order, what they want from the menu that, you know, meets their needs. And for some kids, for some people, for the first year, they don't want anything on the menu. They don't want to be in your restaurant. And then a couple years down the line, they want to try everything on the menu because now they're ready to grieve or something. Or you have a kid who they want to try five things on the menu right after the loss, and then they don't want to be in your restaurant of grief for the next 6 months. And then they want to come back. You know, it, the key is that we have flexibility and the freedom. And when we're allowed that, then we get our needs are met. So should the media be pouncing on these kids and forcing them to talk about their experiences? I would say no, in light of what I've been saying. All right, let's take a break. Get back, more emails. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a new year, so of course it's time for New Year's resolutions. But often, those are just manifestations of internalized harmful voices, voices that tell us we're not good enough. So instead of making a resolution to change something, let's recognize that we are already good enough. Now, most people think of therapy as a place for us to work on our problems, but there are several schools of thought within the field of psychotherapy that adamantly reject that paradigm, like narrative therapy and solution-focused. Instead, these clinicians help us focus on what we're already doing well. And by helping us do that, data shows that we often will gravitate towards more beneficial patterns. Well, one place you can find such therapists is on BetterHelp. If you're thinking of starting therapy, it's definitely worth giving a try. So, celebrate the progress you've already made. Visit betterhelp.com/Kirk today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/Kirk.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.
All right, we're back from the break. So I actually want to go back to the attachment discussion that I was getting into earlier and just say that my approach to using attachment theory with clients and myself in my own personal life is as follows, where I will first assess the reactivity that people have now. Because regardless of where that comes from, if it comes from the past or they were born that way, it doesn't really matter. What matters is, what are they doing now? What sort of distortions do they tend to have? What paranoias do they have? What reactions do they have? What schemas do they have? Do they have a schema that says that they don't have emotions, that they try to deny their own emotions? Do they have a schema that says no one will ever love them? Do they have a schema that says that people are good and trustworthy? You know, I'm looking for evidence of those schemas that are probably a result of their early childhood, but I will never know for sure. There's no way for me to know. So I'm looking at their reactivity today, their assumptions, their core beliefs, their schemas, their working models of self and other, the feelings that that produces, how aware are they of their emotions? How do they express that to their partner? How vulnerable are they? How comfortable are they with vulnerability? What's the pattern? How does it interface and interlace with their partner? What's the system of attachment that the two of them have developed? The routine, the pattern of their conflict and bonding, what does that look like? And then I will start to make some guesses as to where that came from in their childhood by assessing their memory, of course, which is flawed, about their own childhood. And I will tell you that every time I've gone down this road, I have found a very satisfying conceptualization of where their current attachment reactivity comes from their early childhood, first 5 to 10 years. I can almost always find a very satisfying conceptualization. Now, could someone argue that I'm just, it's just confirmation bias? Yeah, 100%. There's no way for me to differentiate my confirmation bias from reality. But I'll tell you that my model helps, because as I seek that out and I will vocalize it, my style of therapy, clients will probably attest to this, that they'll be talking about something that's happening right now. They'll be saying, oh yeah, I got in a fight with my husband and it went down like this and I had this. And so, you know, and then I explore with the client what was happening. And let's say I identify that the client distorted something. And I'd say like, well, it makes sense that you distorted that because as a child, you were forced to assume that that was the case. You know, like an example would be that someone is distant, you know, their partner is very distant or somewhat distant. And in my estimation, they distorted that distance as an indication that the partner wants to leave them. And then I would say, well, it makes sense that you assumed that, that you made that distortion, because when you were a child, that turned out to be more true than not, because suddenly people would abandon you when, and it was preceded by some emotional and behavioral distance. And so you developed a heuristic about this mild emotional indifference towards you. That was a sign that you were about to be abandoned, which is a very concerning thing to a child. And thus you became very aware of that behavior, very aware of that cue. You know, it'd be similar if I rang a bell and then slapped you across the face every time, or even half the time. The next time you heard me ring a bell, you would start to flinch and run away from me, right? Because it's a precursor. And the same goes for why we tend to distort, you know, along these lines with that analogy. Say I, with you, ring a bell and slap you 50% of the time. And then you get into a relationship with someone else and they ring a bell and you automatically assume you're going to be slapped across the face, right? Because that's what always happens. But the next partner might ring a bell and then kiss you, you know? So you just don't know. Someone being emotionally distant could mean that they're about to abandon you, but there's a billion other things it could be, right? So I will always find a very satisfying... So I will point that out to the client. I'll be like, okay, it makes sense. You know, distorted because when you're a kid, da-da-da. And I find this to be a very helpful conceptualization for the client, because they're like, oh, okay, that makes sense. That because everyone needs to understand how they distort things. Everyone needs to understand how they're unreasonably reactive, because we all are like that. And if you just say, well, that's the end of the story, I'm unreasonable and I distort things, then it's not very satisfying. But when we can say, I have a reason for having this model of looking at the world based on my childhood, then it just feels so much better. It doesn't mean we're doomed, but it just means that it lets us off the hook, right? It's not just like we didn't wake up in the morning and decide we're going to distort things for the rest of our lives. So we develop the distortion from our experiences. So do I know that these conceptualizations are quote unquote true? No, I always know that I don't know, but it's so helpful. Oh boy, it's just so helpful to see it that way. In my own life, in my personal life, when I have my distortions and I tie them to my childhood, I'm like, okay, well, it makes sense that I would have that. Then I am able to have self-compassion. I'm able to see my distortion, right? I'm able to look at it and say, okay, there you go. I'm able to apologize or account for it or navigate better. You know, take the person who is aware, you know, so her husband is distant and she has now learned that it has to do with her childhood. And so in her mind, she has a thought of, oh, he wants to leave me. I hate him. I'm going to attack him. But then she takes a beat and she says, well, actually, do I know that? Because he could just be distant, or not even really quote unquote distant. He could just be quiet. Maybe he's just thinking about work or something. And that, you know, I'm assuming things are happening in his head, but I don't know what's happening in his head. So instead, what I will do is I will leave him be, because God knows why he's being quiet. Or I will go to him and say, hey, you're being quiet. Did you want to talk about it? Or, hey, you're being quiet. You're triggering my abandonment fears. Can you just reassure me that you're not abandoning me? You know, and then the partner says, oh, no, sorry. I'm just preoccupied with work. And but no, I will never leave you because I love you. Yeah, that kind of thing. So when you have that ability to see yourself and to react in a more functional way, things tend to go better. Do I know that attachment theory is true, or that my model of looking at things are true, or that my conceptualization of individuals are true? No, I can't. There's no way for me to know, but I find it to be very helpful. All right, this next email is from anonymous listener. They write, "I am a physician and I think that you are awesome. However, I find it dangerous that you are promoting that psychologists should be able to prescribe medication, because before prescribing, there are many medical issues we have to take into consideration. In addition, some medications require medical monitoring and frequent labs. Psychologists are not able to monitor metabolism syndrome, interactions of psychiatric medications with other non-psychiatric medications, or monitor QTC intervals, et cetera, et cetera. Medical school is 4 years and psychiatry residency is 4 years. In addition, there's a reason why it takes so long. What are your thoughts?" End of email. Yeah. So this isn't my area. So I don't know all the ins and outs of it. So I'll speak from my limited understanding. The second thing I'll say is that, was I promoting that psychologists should be able to prescribe medication? Was that what I guess it's possible I was promoting it, but that certainly isn't my stance. I don't give a crap. I guess I was promoting it probably by saying that according to experts that I know, they find that it is something that we should be adding to the options available to people seeking medication, because psychologists will, and research apparently shows this, you know, an expert, a friend of mine was telling me about this research, that psychologists tend to prescribe less because they have more tools available to them. You know, they tend to have more tools, more psychological, psychotherapeutic tools. Many psychiatrists are very good at psychotherapy, but many psychiatrists don't have any idea, or they might have done a little bit of psychiatry or psychotherapy during their medical training, but that was a long time ago and they don't do it anymore. So it's complicated and it's case by case basis, but yeah, okay. So I'll accept the accusation that I was promoting that psychologists should be able to prescribe medication. But with a huge asterisk to that, which is that for a psychologist to be able to prescribe and monitor medication, they have to get additional education and supervision, and there have to be a lot of systems in place. And I would imagine, and again, this isn't my area, that a helpful, ethical, science-based model would be you would have a psychologist that gets the regular psychologist training like myself, and you take maybe an additional 1 or 2 years of education on psychopharmacology. And that would include some biology that are, you know, like the labs and the medical monitoring and the non-psychiatric medication interactions that you're talking about, with a heavy amount of caution to these individuals that they're not medical professionals and thus need to be able to flag certain issues that they should refer to a psychiatrist or a different medical professional, which is already true. I mean, people will come to me and talk about something they're going through, and we all know that any psychological issue could be related to a biological issue that I will have no idea how to assess. Someone could be complaining about relationship problems, but really what's happening is they have a thyroid problem, for example, and they have a behavioral manifestation of that. And I could be providing them with all the psychotherapy in the world. I'm never going to be able to assess or treat the thyroid problem. So having some ability to screen for medical issues and referring people to someone else who might be able to zero in on what that problem is absolutely a big part of our practice, regardless of if we're a psychologist providing medication or not. I would assume that competent psychologists that provide medication know enough about biology to know when they need to refer. So that would be a big part of it. The other thing, you know, psychiatrist as a physician, anonymous listener, I understand that to have psychologists weasel their way in on your business would be distressing to you, you know, and this happens all the time, that when you feel insecure about your business and someone else comes along, you know, like right now, we have all these coaches, right? Life coaches that are quote unquote weaseling their way into psychotherapy. And so what you will see is most people in my field, it's lessening over time, but I would say most people in my field loathe life coaches and will make fun of them and say that they're unethical and all these kinds of things. And there's some wisdom to that because there are unethical, horrible things happening within the coaching world. I mean, just Google it or go on YouTube and these quote unquote life coaches, it's just atrocious, some of the things they're doing. However, there are many life coaches that are probably, and I, you know, anecdotally, I've seen this, are doing really great work within their scope, right? So another example is that psychiatrists actually in Texas spent thousands of dollars lobbying politicians to make it so that people like myself, licensed marriage and family therapists, could not diagnose their clients. The psychiatrists in Texas claimed that I do not have the qualifications to diagnose someone based on my license. And why would they do that? Well, either they were misinformed or they felt insecure about their business. They wanted all the money to themselves and didn't want us, people like me, to have clients. And thus, we're trying to edge us out. Because if you can't diagnose someone, you can't bill insurance at all. And thus you basically have no career. You have no reason to exist. If you're a marriage and family therapist, I mean, obviously you could be in private practice and not be involved in the insurance side of things, but you know, I'm just going to take a guess and say at least 90% of clients are using insurance in the United States. And so I don't know the motivation of the psychiatrist in Texas, but as a physician yourself, you're like, wait, people from outside the medical profession are weaseling their way into the medical profession. I don't feel comfortable about that. And okay, let's look into it. Let's make sure that it's not a problem. And if it is a problem, then let's say don't do it. But from what I understand from experts in the field, it's already been tested, I think, for 15 years-ish or something at least. And it's fine. It's good. The research has shown that the problems that you would imagine would happen don't happen to any greater degree than they would with a medical psychiatrist. Don't quote me on that. All right, this last email is from good old Balas. He writes a pretty long email that I read in detail. And basically what he's saying is that he's in his mid-20s and he feels like he's a loser, quote unquote. He says, I am someone who might be called a loser, he says. He says, I've never had a relationship. I've never had a job longer than a month. I am still living with my parents. I am lazy. All I do is watch YouTube and think about life, but that doesn't get me anywhere. I have no hopes for the future. And in his email, his main questions are like, should I feel bad about myself? Is it too late for me to change? How do people get relationships? How do people get motivated to achieve things like go to college and get a job or move out of the house? I mean, how does this happen? Another section of the email talked about how Balas's parents were difficult and I think traumatic to Balas. So what I'll say is that there's no way for me to provide an answer to your questions in a satisfying way. But I've worked with a lot of people, personal and clients that are in a similar category as yourself. And what I'll say is this. One, you're in your mid-20s, so your question, is it too late? No. I see 25-year-olds as basically still teenagers, in terms of life stage. So, you got all the time in the world, so don't worry. I have students who enter my university at the age of 65 years old. So, you have a lot of years ahead of you in terms of figuring out your career and life. The other thing I'll say is that it sounds like, Balas, for you, you experienced some pretty difficult times growing up, which you actually had a section where you're talking about how only recently did you start to even recognize your own needs and your own wants. So there's a good possibility that, so let me give you two profiles of people with your background. One person is like you, which I'll describe in a second, but another person, which I don't know if I conceptualize you you know, in a way that would make sense to you, but I'll just, anyway. But another, the other type of person is they go through these difficulties early in life and they are highly driven. They're perfectionistic and they never think about their own needs. They're always trying to please other people. They know their parents want them to go to college, so they go to college. But they don't know if they want to go to college. They know their parents want them to become a doctor or a lawyer, so they become a doctor or a lawyer. But they don't know if they want to become a doctor or a lawyer. You know, and they just go through their life like that. And they're miserable on the inside, but they're achieving a lot of things. Okay. So then, but that person doesn't know what they want. Another person who might be like yourself, Balas, who also doesn't know what they want because they were never attuned to well enough and they were just surviving, they decide a different path where they're not going to become perfectionistic and overachieving and they're just going to do nothing. But again, they don't know what they want. And so you compare those two profiles, those two paths from a childhood that is difficult. One looks great from the outside because they're a doctor and they graduated top of their class and they have a house and a car and they don't live at home anymore. And to the outside, to the American ideal, to the Western ideal, the materialistic ideal, that person looks great. Okay, they have some traumas, but boy, what? How much have they accomplished? The second person looks like a loser. They're like, oh, what a sad individual. Both people are just as problematic. They're the same. They have the same problem. The first person who is achieving, they have achieved, in actuality, nothing because they've only achieved what other people wanted them to achieve. And that, in some ways, can actually distract individuals from what, Balas, you know. You know you don't know what you want or have only begun to discover that. You know there's something wrong with the path of your life, or you know you want something different. To the person who is the doctor, they could go their entire life without ever knowing that they should stop and think, do I want this? Because everyone's constantly telling them that their life is so great. So you might actually be in a better position, an earlier position to develop the ability to start beginning the foundation to build your life. So that's what I don't know if that describes you, Balas, but that's one thing I'll say. The other thing I'll say is in your email, there's a ton of self-hatred in your email. I won't go into all of it, but, and that's a schema, my friend. There is nothing wrong with you. You stay at home and you watch YouTube and you don't have a job and you live with your parents. Big deal. At least you're not, I don't know if you're not, but I'm guessing you're not like a QAnon person or. Point is that there are a lot of things to be ashamed of in your life. What you have is there's nothing to be ashamed of. I know our society will shame you, but we all understand our society is stupid in a variety of ways, and this is one of them. So if you are abusing your parents and saying you must pay for my rent and buy my food, then yeah, there's something wrong with you. But if you're just taking a little long to cook in the oven because you were denied a good amount of cooking when you were younger, you know what I'm saying? You know, you're still in the oven. You're still cooking. You're still thinking. You're still, you know, in your email, you say that you have the mindset of like a 14-year-old where you're just now beginning to grasp what you want. And that's a very apt analogy because if we really think of you that way, because developmentally you were denied those stages earlier in life, then it makes sense that you're still living at home and you don't know what you want and you're not oriented towards achievement. But if you keep going and you stop beating yourself up and just allow yourself to spread your wings as they develop, then you'll be okay. And this self-deprecation and the self-hatred and the putting yourself down is an internalized voice from the outside that was originally outside, but now it's inside. And that will keep you back. If you want things to be different and you continue to berate yourself, you probably will not change. It's similar to weight loss or any kind of habit change that we go through. A good portion of us are prevented from change because of the way we talk to ourselves, but it's because of these internalized voices. So you really have to push against that. There's nothing wrong with your life. You're fine. You live at home. You're 26 years old. You haven't met the woman of, you know, you say that you've always wanted to have a girlfriend and You're just like, what's wrong with me? How come I can't, you know, okay. Your life is before you. And I don't know what will happen in your future. There's a lot of paths in life, but there's no reason to believe that if you work on it little by little, pay attention to what you want and stop beating yourself up, that you won't get there. But if you continue to beat yourself up and just resign, then yeah, a lot of people will stay in that spot. The other thing I'll say is there's nothing wrong staying in that spot. You could stay at home with your parents, never have a girlfriend. You also in your email talked about having lots of friends. I think you have happiness in your life to some extent, right? You could stay in that lifestyle for the rest of your life and there'd be nothing wrong with it. It would not be, not a lot of parents are going to have a bumper sticker saying my 45-year-old son still lives at home and I'm proud of myself as a parent. You know, you're not going to see that bumper sticker because our society is stupid, but there's nothing wrong with it. You understand? There are things you could do in life that we could judge you for, like believing that Tom Hanks is a reptile person who preys on the blood of infants and satanic rituals, which is what QAnon people literally believe, by the way, and then propagate that information and try to harm Tom Hanks over that. Yeah, that's immoral. We should ridicule that and judge that. Those people should, to some extent, hate themselves for participating in that. What you're doing is you're at home. The other thing I'll say is that many years ago, decades ago, what we predicted what would happen by now, by 2022, is that our automated system of labor with robots and other kind of stuff would mean that as Americans, we wouldn't have to work as much as we did at the time. They said, okay, well, what's the result of all this automation? You know, the internet, robots, and blah, blah, blah. What's going to happen? Well, it's going to put humans out of a job. Well, what does that mean? Well, what that means is that on average, we won't have to work as much. And some of us won't have to work at all for us to have a functional society. But that did not happen because we kept adding more work to people's lives. And materialism increased and keeping up with the Joneses increased, which I have definitely noticed in my lifetime. And when I think about what the average person, aspired to when in the 70s, 80s, and 90s is so far below what people aspire to today in terms of material gain. People want giant homes and brand new cars and live in very nice neighborhoods and be able to eat at the nicest restaurants every night. I mean, everyone wants to be like a king and a queen in their own kingdom. And I'm just like, lower your expectations because you're probably just going to harm yourself to achieve all that. Anyway, so yeah, what I'll say is that in a perfect world, if we were actually thinking logically as a society, not everyone would be working today. Not everyone would have to have a 60-hour a week job. Some people could just stay at home with their parents and watch YouTube and think about life, like as a career. That's where we should be heading. Or all of us should be working less. We should all be working 20-hour work weeks, which around the world and in some organizations in the United States, they are actually adhering to those philosophies and thinking we don't need to push ourselves constantly. It's not inherently true. We can actually scale back, enjoy life, have some balance in life. That's okay. And there's actually, I think, and don't quote me on this, but that when we look at hunter-gatherer societies today and throughout history, when we would observe their daily routine, these people tended to work far less than the way we work today. And because we have this idea of hunter-gatherers as constantly working, right? They have to constantly hunt and constantly gather and constantly build shelters also. And what they found was that on average, they worked very few hours of the day. It didn't take that long to keep everyone alive, which meant that you could spend much more time relaxing and bonding and doing fun things with your family and your kids, which is perhaps our natural state. But when agriculture came along, it meant we had to work a lot harder for each calorie. And then that extended into our contemporary world where people work 70 hours a week when they probably could legitimately get by on 25 hours a week or even less. So So that's just me talking about that, and you don't have to adhere to that, boss. But my point is that you're okay. You know, just take your time, continue to think about what you need, who you want to be, if you want to achieve it all. You know, don't listen to yourself, listen to your heart. Listen to your heart. Is that a Roxette song? And stop judging yourself and really push back at the internalized voices that you've incurred. Recognize that your delay in understanding what you want and achieving, quote unquote, could absolutely be attributed to what you went through as a child. And that's not your fault. That's okay. If you had achieved a lot because you pushed yourself artificially, that wouldn't be a better life necessarily. You could actually congratulate yourself for not going down that overachieving lifestyle. That with the lifestyle you have, you actually have the time to think about what you want, to relax, to take your time, you know, take your time. It's okay. Regarding the question of like, how do you get a girlfriend? When people come to me as, you know, as a therapist and say, I'm having trouble finding romance in my life, can you help me? Every story is different and every solution is different. So there's so many different things one should cover. And so maybe that's the best tip I could say is, if you really want romance in your life, then, because there's a question as to whether or not you're just imposing that from the outside, but if you really do want it from the inside, then start to problem solve. Where are the barriers? And for heaven's sake, do not give in to certain schemas like, well, there, you know, dating is impossible these days, because it's not. Or I'm not attractive, because that's ridiculous. Or I'm a dork, no one's going to love me, that's ridiculous. Or they don't have women that are the sort of woman I'm looking for. You know, I'm doomed because my compatibility woman, she's not out there anymore. That's also ridiculous. Or feminism is ruining society or whatever. All those notions are ridiculous because romance and love are happening every second of every day around the world. So know that it can happen and in all likelihood will happen, but you have to problem solve. You have to figure out, okay, what's preventing me from reaching out? And then if I do reach out, what's preventing me from really living in the moment? What's preventing me from seeing the good in other people? What's preventing me? What worry do I have? And what could I do to address that worry? How am I coming across to other people? Am I choosing the right sort of people to date? Are my expectations too high? Are they too low? You know, there's so many different factors. You just keep kind of muddling your way through it. And if you truly want it, you'll find a lid for your pot, if you will, in all likelihood. I can't guarantee that. Because the reason why I can say this, boss, is because so many people are looking for partners of various genders, of various sexual orientations. So for every cis hetero dude who is sitting at home going, I wish I could meet someone, there's a heterosexual woman out there that is thinking the same thing. I wish I could meet someone. Dating is so hard. I wish, will anyone ever love me? You know, there are so many people out there, you know, that are thinking the exact same thing. And even if we zoom out to just friendships as well, there's so many people that are like, I wish I had more friends. And everyone's just sitting at home giving up and not problem solving, not figuring out what's going on. Like for me, I'll just tell you for my own life, when it comes to friends, that at a certain point I realized that if I didn't initiate and or capitalize when other people were initiating, even when it wasn't obvious to me, then I would never have any friends. And I remember, I think I was in my early 30s or something. Cause you know, in my 20s, I just had friends that it was just by default, people that you just always hung out with. But getting into your 30s, those relationships start to drift away. And so I started realizing, oh, unless I reach out or respond when people reach out to me, I will be alone and have no friends. And so I went on a campaign. There would be certain people that I would sort of target and say, I want to be friends with that person. So I'm going to bother that person and I'm going to invite them 5 times and they'll be busy, but I'm going to keep at it. And eventually we'll get into a routine and then we'll be a part of each other's lives. In some ways, Rebecca was that way with me. When I first met her at the university, you know, we were lumped together because we were both 40 at the time or around there, and everyone else was in their 60s and 70s. And so incidentally, we were both given jobs that involved like computer knowledge. We became like the IT department of the psychology professors, which is just ridiculous because her and I are not computer experts, but because we were young, we were just given that mantle. Anyway, so in fact, that's how I met her, because when I became full-time, she was in charge of training everyone on a certain system. Anyway, so when I met her, I really liked her, but I didn't think she would want to be friends with me, so I never bothered pursuing her. But over time, she just kept at it. She just kept inviting me to things and reaching out, and then I would respond by doing things. But over time, I started noticing, wow, you know, she really reaches out a lot to me. I think she wants to be a friend. It took me a while to kind of figure it out. And here we are. Now me and Rebecca are really close. We're good friends. And we, you know, when in doubt, we text each other, kind of a thing. She's one of those people in my life. That's because both of us put effort. We had to consciously think, okay, I'm going to put effort into this. Because if we just act naturally, we probably would have drifted apart, because there's not a huge reason, especially after she left Antioch, there's not a huge reason why we would ever hang out again, right? So it's that kind of thing. That's how you develop relationships. Now, Balas, for you, you have a lot of friends. You already talked about that. So, but apply that to romantic relationships. You know, if you don't try and initiate things and accept that sometimes things won't go well, then nothing will ever happen for you. Anyway, that's just one of the things. But so I don't know, Balas, if that helps at all, but I thought I would just ramble. And everyone out there, please take care of yourself, because you deserve it. You really, really do.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes.
ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.